Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Joining in today by Josh Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project. Welcome back, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure.
Good.
A lot going on.
Yeah, there's some things.
You know, we were talking about a completely different subject while we wasted the studio staff's time catching up. But, you know, what we did think we'd do today is look at some of the underlying attitudes that, you know, might be in play in the public's response to events in Minneapolis. And if you're listening to this, you know what I'm talking about. Most recently, the killing of a 37-year-old nurse practitioner by federal immigration enforcement officials in Minneapolis on Saturday. And, you know, this comes on the heels of another fatal shooting and another shooting injury by federal officers in this very high-profile surge in Minneapolis, which has been contested in court by many Minneapolis leaders. And, you know, their contestation has been counter-contested in court by the Trump administration, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot going on here. But obviously, you know, we were talking about this on the way in. You know, this was the dominant story after it happened on Saturday. You know, continues to be pretty dominant, but we're now in about the, as we record this on Thursday, you know, what, the fifth day or so of the news cycle on this. And it's still, you know, what we used to call above the fold. But, you know, beginning, you know, and we can unpack this, beginning that, you know, to my mind, both on one hand, spread in other directions, which I'll mention in a second, but also inexorably getting sucked into the normal, the flow of politics is normal, might we say, you know, for, you know, whatever the level of normal we're at now. But
yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you and I spoke over the weekend, and I think, you know, we have an interesting look at events because we get to measure the feedback, right, that the public gives to a lot of things. And so I think in general, I'm reluctant to say, you know, that something's a big event or that it's going to create some kind of a huge, you know, ripple or anything like that, because for the most part, you know, people don't pay attention to a lot of stuff. Even beyond that, in the current environment, people's consumption of habits are just so vastly, you know, kind of just fractured and unique in all these different ways. But there was something about this event. And also, and I pointed this out to you at the time, it's like taking place on a really cold weekend in which a lot of people were just stuck inside.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah. You know, in front of the TV, in front of their phones, screens, whatever.
Yeah, you weren't doing something that allowed you to easily, like, avoid this news.
Right. You know, and when we did last week's podcast and we were, you know, talking about campaigns, I made something of an aside about how there were things that were going to get coverage because people were tuning into the weather.
Yeah.
You know, what it was, I guess what I was talking about was campaign ads.
Mm-hmm.
But this story got dropped into that dynamic.
Right.
Where if you were checking, you know, the national outlets for a weather check.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of cases, you didn't see weather stories, or in between, you know, while waiting for a weather story, you saw wall-to-wall coverage of the shooting.
Right, so, that's right.
And I, you know, I mentioned that it spread. In addition to the intrinsic impact of another American citizen being killed as part of these protests related to the Trump administration's federal immigration surge and killed by federal officers, there have been significant reactions and ripple, somewhat second order effects, you know, most of which I think we'll touch on here. But just, you know, it's caused some disruptions in the force, if you will, in Republican Party politics. We'll dig into a little more. Added to the battles in Congress, supercharged Democrats' bargaining position and shutdown talks, revolving around authorization bills that are going to involve or that involve the Department of Homeland Security, right, of which this is all a part. And that is a very pressing wave,
right,
given that Congress is trying to pass these funding bills by the January 31st deadline to avert another partial shutdown.
Right.
So let's start, I guess, with national polling. I mean, there's been a little bit of national polling done, and then we'll dig a little bit more. There hasn't been much polling done, any polling I know I've done directly focused on Texas since then. But we've got some national polling to look at.
Yeah, and I mean, I hate to say that it's, you know, sort of predictable if you look at polling really closely, but it is somewhat predictable. So looking at some YouGov polling, you know, what they found, at least.
And this was actually the right after.
This was right after.
The notes I had right before,
but yeah, that was so
something else
that
we'll talk about in a second. This was the day after, and this was they really, you know, jammed the box on this in polling terms, and that they got a sample of
almost
4,000 U.S. adults on the day after the shooting. So they went for it.
They went for it. And what they found was that, you know, overall, 48% of Americans said that they thought the shooting was not justified. 20%, 1 in 5, thought it was justified, and about a third said they weren't sure. And that's important. Like, let's, you know, we'll kind of come back to that in a second here. Not surprisingly, most Democrats, 83%, said this was not a justified shooting. Among independents, which we keep flagging here because, you know, elections are coming up, you know, not the primaries, but the general, and it is worth looking at. A majority, 50%, said it wasn't justified. 37% said they weren't sure. Only 13% of independents thought the shooting was justified. Now, the Republicans are where we're starting to see. This is, you know, where we're going to really dig in here. Among Republicans, only 13% in this, again, almost day after, said it was not justified. 44% said it was, 43% not sure. So even, you know, so almost 90% of Republicans were evenly split between the shooting being justified and saying not sure. Not sure is always a very, you know, as we talk about a lot, you know, what that means and why people are in that category is an interesting thing. Some of that can be real lack of knowledge. Like, I just don't know about this. I haven't been paying attention to it. I was whatever. This was the day after. Some of that is, you know, I've seen some stuff, but I'm not ready to render judgment. Some of that is I'm trying to deal with the mixed messages that I'm receiving right now.
Based on my priors.
Based on my priors. Exactly.
Because it's fair to point out that only, if this was the day after and the video was still rolling out, only 13% of Democrats said they were not sure.
Right.
Yeah. So to be somewhat symmetrical, I don't want to say fair, but you know, it's not really fair or not fair. But to look at, you know, to look at this somewhat globally, Democrats were pretty quick to say that was not justified.
Yeah, and I think what I would
say, I'm not saying that's entirely partisan. I mean, but it is striking.
But it points to something that I think we find often in these kinds of things, which is it would be easy to go to the 43% of Republicans saying not sure and say, well, surely those are people who are withholding judgment until they know more. But the thing is, we can look at the Democrats and say, well, the Democrats aren't withholding judgment. And you'd say, well, is that because the Democrats are just quick to judge? It's like, no, it's because Republicans are dealing with a cross currents of information in the aftermath of this that they don't really know what to respond to, which is kind of what we're going to talk about today, which is like, why is this so difficult? And what is it that, you know, we could see people responding to in this, that's making this such a political mess, really?
And not to rely on an overused, somewhat sometimes sloppy term, but there's a degree of the operation of motivated reasoning.
We're going to come back to motivated reasoning. So
which
I'm
is,
sure.
is playing a pretty big role in the partisan differences and the degree to which you kind of got at this, but I want to line it out a little bit differently, which is if you've got these conflicting impulses that are driven in part by your predispositions that align with your partisanship, we're going to see this kind of gap.
Yeah, you're looking for confirmatory information always. We all do this. And this is just the thing. This isn't about partisans. This isn't about, you know, any sort of ideology. In general, if you believe something, you are going to seek out, find, accept, encode all the fancy words that we use in psychology. Receive, it's less fancy, but it's in there, this information because it coheres with what you already know. And if it doesn't, you are less likely to even hear it. If it does come in, you're likely to reject it. And you're even less likely to encode it as a new piece of information that you kind of think about and consider.
And so some kind of, you know, opinion formation that comes out of that.
Right.
There's going to be less hesitation on the part of people that agree, you know, in this case, there's going to be less hesitation among Democrats than there's among Republicans.
Right. And so I think that speaks to one of the other national sort of pieces of the polling data here, which is, I'm going to focus on the second one here, which is essentially this question. And we ask a similar kind of question.
This was a Reuters Ipsos poll that was in the field. It straddled the shooting. So
right.
As I remember the numbers, about two-thirds of the sample of the data was collected before the shooting, about a third after.
Okay. And so what we found is, or what they found was that asked whether ICE agents, you know, basically are going too far, aren't going far enough, or their efforts are about right, basically, in terms of their efforts to deal with unauthorized immigration in the country. The important thing to sort of pull out of this from my perspective is that, you know, 78% of Republicans in the sample said either that what the efforts so far have been about right, that was 55%, that's the majority, or that they haven't gone far enough. It's about a quarter, 23%. So about four-fifths of the Republicans nationally in the lead-up, again, straddling this event, said that the efforts of ICE so far, again, even with, again, there was a shooting of a U.S. citizen before this.
There's already been two shootings before the shooting this weekend.
Exactly. And it was still the case that about four-fifths of Republicans were saying, no, this is about right, or it could go a little bit further. And so we're going to come back around to this, but it's sort of important to point that out that, you know, in general, there can be disagreement with an action, with an incident, with some tactics, but it's important to remember here in terms of thinking about the overall political fallout of it and how far back the walk back's going to be, if there is one, the negotiations ongoing in Congress, is that for a vast majority of the majority party at the federal level, there is still broad support for the goals of what they're trying to achieve here. Even if, you know, even if it's gotten messy.
Okay, so we'll unpack a little bit more how developments in the last few hours, if not 12 or so, play into that. But let's dig in a little bit and unpack. What we can do is use Texas as something of a case study here, because we have lots of potentially relevant data, much of which you gathered up in our polling archives. And again, if you want to look for this data, if you're new to the podcast or have not done it before, texaspolitics.utexas.edu, we've got a pretty useful search engine that covers polling going back to 2008, lots of graphics, free downloads, but easy to look up by topic, person, et cetera, and look at subgroups. So you too can do this at home. You know, we're saying that there's a lot of potentially relevant data, and you've made the point potentially is kind of the word. I mean, we have to do some stitching together, and there's some, we want to be careful to not overinterpret, as we often say, not do what we're always urging other people to do. But there are a lot of things that we've got in our archive that we've asked fairly recently about attitudes towards the Trump administration's efforts on mass deportation, but also in terms of the cross currents here, attitude towards free speech rights, protest, attitude towards gun ownership, all of which are in play here, just to set that up. So let's start with the immigration data. What would you bring to the table on that?
Well, I think, you know, the first thing to point out, I mean, I think as observers of just, you know, sort of the Texas response to what went on in Minnesota, is that, you know, it's pretty remarkable that, you know, the weekends of the event brought, you know, none other than, you know, Governor Abbott and Senator Cruz out to say that maybe, just maybe, that the Trump administration's enforcement policy might need some recalibration. I think that was the word, you know, that was being used here, right? And a lot of it was being couched in the sense of, you know, look, in the service of respect for law enforcement, we need to recalibrate, which, again, it's very well chosen and very specifically chosen. So, you know, just to kind of go back, I mean, again, same thing that Ipsos asked, we asked back in December about views on the Trump administration's enforcement of federal immigration laws. And what we found was pretty, you know, similar numbers, though with a little bit more Texas, right? So whereas at the national level, 78% of Republicans either said that it was about right or had not gone far enough, in Texas, 87% said the administration either had been about right or not gone far enough. And here, as opposed to the majority saying about right, which was 55% of the national level, in Texas, they were split. So 42% of Republicans said the administration's enforcement has been about right. 45% say that it had not gone far enough. That's the plurality.
And given the subsample size, kind of an even split.
Yeah, I'd definitely call that an even split. I mean, interestingly enough, given the way that they actually did partisanship in the national poll, we have similar numbers of Republicans, to be fair. But it's not also surprising to see a little bit more enforcement onus here in Texas, where, you know,
sure,
the border is more prescient and salient, and immigration is a different thing, as you all know, listening to this. So this is just to say, we know that Republican voters hadn't balked at any of the tactics up until this point. We also know that when we ask Texas voters in a repeated question about their support for the idea of the immediate deportation of all undocumented immigrants currently living in the U.S., which presumably, just to flesh out, means beyond the border, into the cities, into the towns, kind of what is going on here. What you do find is, for, you know, a long time, and really looking at the polling, you know, allowing for some margin of error, just for the simplest of, just to convey the information, more than 80% of Republican voters since at least 2021 have agreed with this approach, that we need to deport all undocumented immigrants currently living in the U.S. Right. immediately. So 4 out of 5, going back to that kind of number again, about 80%. So if you think about it, what that tells us is that, you know, one, the goal of immediate deportation of everybody is really, you know, a driving
support
consideration.
For that, yeah, support for that remains intact, if not, you know, I would add to your characterization of that, if you look at the trend data on that I think we posted last week, but I'll post again with this on the website, it's actually at its highs right now.
Yeah, it's probably grown a little bit over prior periods. Now, the important, so as we said, you know, this underlying support for immediate deportations exists amongst the majority party. In addition, here in Texas and nationally, there is this general sense that the administration has not necessarily gone too far in these efforts. However, and this is the really important however, I think, you know, that doesn't mean that there aren't limits here, right? So back in February of 2025, you know, we asked about support for different kind of objects and locations of, you know, the enforcement efforts of these sort of these deportation efforts. And we found a fair amount of variance even among Republicans. Now, this doesn't mean that there was, you know, widespread disagreement among Republicans, you know, about these efforts, but there wasn't actually a ton of agreement. So what we find, you know, when we look at sort of what we would call asylum seekers, people who are allowed into the U.S. because of, you know, safety concerns in their own country, 48% of Republicans in Texas supported deporting those people, 40% opposed it. When we look at arresting people at hospitals, 47% support, 43% oppose, again, among Republicans. People while they're at church was 47-42 again. And then anything having to do with children, there was actually majority Republican opposition in terms of looking for children at school, separating children from their parents, and even deporting people who were brought to the U.S. illegally as children and then have lived here since then. And so this isn't to say that, you know, this, just to be really clear here, we're not saying, oh, that 40% to 50% of Republicans who are opposed to some of those enforcement mechanisms are all of a sudden going to turn around, because we know from the other data that in general, they're supportive of the overall mission, which is these mass deportation efforts. But that doesn't mean, obviously, that the tactics don't matter. And that's kind of wherein lies some of the problem with this, because there is a strong level of support for, you know, really effective and rigorous immigration enforcement in the party on the one hand, but the sort of, you know, where the bright lines are is a lot less clear.
Well, there's an interesting, you know, I mean, a lot of this is about, particularly in this battery, time, you know, location and circumstance.
Right.
There's evidence that there's a safe harbor for the administration based on this other data you're talking about, for the focus on quote unquote criminals. In other words, people that are here illegally and have violated subsequent laws other than being here, you know, without documentation. So I think one of the interesting side shots of this, and it's a minor thing, and I don't want to go, you know, is again something we talked about last week or the week before, and that is the break between immigration and border security.
Mm-hmm.
The terrain of the issue has changed somewhat now that the border is quiet, and I think we talked about that last week or the week before. We don't have to beat that to death again, but that is at play here, and I think we are seeing the administration calibrating this on an ongoing basis in terms of immigration now. This case, clearly very, very much complicated in comparison to previous cases by the Second Amendment issues that this shooting has risen. So for those of you that most of you will know this, but just to make sure everybody's on the same page, the individual that was killed on Saturday was, by all reports, licensed to carry legally in Minnesota, which is a permit carry state.
Shall carry state.
Shall carry state. And that has been incorporated in, at least initially, in some politically, I would say politically, demonstrably politically unwise ways.
Right.
By some early members of the Trump administration. So another set of attitudes we want to talk about, just to put some meat on the bone, is the attitudes that Texans have about gun rights.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, this is something that, look, you don't need to listen to a podcast where we talk about public opinion to know that, gun rights have been central to the Republican Party platform for a long time here in Texas and elsewhere. And in general, if you've been paying attention here in Texas, there's been a pretty, I would say, concerted push over the last decade to loosen the state's gun laws in ways that are based specifically around the constitutional right of Texans and Americans to carry their guns really where, in most cases.
An expansive understanding of the Second Amendment.
Yeah, in most cases, wherever they want. I mean, the issue has really been about, whether there are any limits to that, not whether it's a good idea. And in fact, we see that in a bunch of the attitudes that we've looked at, right? Where when we ask people recently about whether the gun laws in Texas, which are now pretty permissive, should be made more strict, less strict, left as they are now. Majority of Republicans in the state are happy with the laws as they've been made more permissive. 53% say leave them alone. Another quarter say, hey, you can make them less strict, right? And the thing is, if we were going to go, and I didn't pull out the date, I should have, but if we were to look at the voters who say they're the most conservative in the electorate, the share who say that we should make them less strict is going to go up again and again. And therein kind of lies the real challenge about questioning when and where people can carry guns as part of the response to this from Republicans. Because ultimately the other issue is that, that just does not cohere with Republican attitudes where, there's this question we've asked, we should probably ask it again at some point soon, but we ask this question, would the U.S. be more or less safe if more people carried guns? And usually we ask this with a sufficient distance in the wake of a mass shooting to see what people think. The majority of Republicans, the last time we asked this was in 2024, and this is pretty consistent, 51, I think there's actually a low point, as I recall, 51% of Republicans said that we would be more safe if more people were carrying guns around. So the idea that in the wake of something like this, the answer is the guns were the problem really flies in the face of everything we know about Republican opinion, which tends to say, no, that's not the issue here. The issue can't be the guns. It's the people, which is where we kind of move back to, well, who are the people?
Yeah, and the just narratives. To refresh our narrative on this, the idea that Texas would become what is now essentially a constitutional carry state, to use the language of the advocates.
Right. But
in other words, gun rights without any requirement of being permitted with relatively limited restrictions on gun ownership, means that the messaging was going to, the initial messaging that we heard and that we continue to hear really even after the backlash started, was going to be a problem. So let's listen to a couple examples of that just to make it clear we're not making this up. So here we've brought a couple of sound bites. First from Homeland Security Kristi Noem, and then second from President Trump himself. And just to put these in sequence, the Kristi Noem clip was from shortly. It was the first press conference that Homeland Security had after the shooting. The clip from President Trump is from, I believe, Tuesday afternoon, so about 3 days later.
And he's heading to a helicopter, so it's very noisy.
Yeah, it's noisy. And
it was a scrum
rather than an interior press conference. Okay, so let's roll those clips.
Individuals showed up to impede a law enforcement operation and assaulted our officers. They responded according to their training and took action to defend the officer's life and those of the public around him. And I don't know of any peaceful protester that shows up with a gun and ammunition rather than a sign. This is a violent riot when you have someone showing up with weapons and are using them to assault law enforcement officers.
But that being said, you can't have guns. You can't walk in with guns. You just can't. And you can't, listen, you can't walk in with guns. You can't do that. But it's just a very unfortunate incident.
Okay, so we should point out, as I said, there was about 72 hours or so difference between the Noem comments and then the Trump comments that we played there. And the Trump comments came at the end of the same press gaggle in which the president began his comments, at least related to this topic, by trying to back away from the early hot responses from people like Noam without really throwing her under the bus directly. But and it was not just Kristi Noem, the other presidential ranking official, Stephen Miller, Border Patrol honcho Gregory Scavino, since shown the door in Minneapolis. They were not alone in this. And even Donald Trump had started that press conference on at least one part of the message. I'll step aside from saying what I think his intent was here, because whoever knows. But the thrust by Tuesday afternoon was to say, we're sending border czar Tom Homan in there to reset. We are going to, consider resetting things here and lowering the temperature. But then at the end of the very scrum, just 10 or 15 minutes later, to go back to our main point at this right now, he repeated really the spirit of what Kristi Noem said, to the effect that if somebody brings a gun to a protest, I'm being a little flippier, all bets are off. Yeah. It's kind of the message.
Yeah, look, chasing hypocrisy is a fool's game in politics. So I'm not even trying to do that, and I don't think it matters. And I think there have been some real misfires from some of the Democratic response on how to, if they want to exacerbate the tension that's existing within Republicans politics right now. That has, in some ways, they've got their own thing going on. They don't necessarily need to involve themselves in this because it's problematic enough as is. But, we live here in Texas, and from time to time, we go to various sort of political events, usually as an observer, in most cases. Sometimes I'm interested to see what's going on, to hear what some speakers, both parties, honestly. I got to be honest, I can't think of many, Republican rallies I've been to where people weren't openly carrying, various guns and different, and again, in the different sort of Texas regimes of gun ownership, they used to be rifles, and then now it's kind of changed over time as the laws have changed. But It's kind of just, I would expect it in most cases. So it's sort of an odd position. And I think it's something that probably struck a lot of Republican, if you're campaigning right now in Republican primaries around Texas and you're going to events and you're going to these, these various, Republican heavy events, people are carrying. And none of them think that they should worry or have any reason to fear for their safety or their constitutional rights because they're carrying at these events.
Yes.
And so I think, in and of itself, that's just sort of, it's just so off the mark in terms of people's lived experience and the rhetoric that honestly has been surrounding guns, for as long as you want to put that time frame on it.
We saw, to take that even a step further nationally, it became a point of contention that during the period when there were protests from the left, Black Lives Matter protests, et cetera, it became fairly commonplace for counter protesters to show up open carrying.
Right.
And, with various degrees of claims of community security or just expression rights, et cetera. And again, this is not to try to make some kind of hypocrisy argument. Yeah. It is to point out that this was an, ultimately in political terms, to put it in stark terms, this was an unsustainable position.
Yeah.
As articulated in the clips that we just played.
Right. And it remains so.
That is not, and it is one of the reasons that the Trump administration is trying to lower the temperature and shift gears here. And also, I would expect that they will take advantage of the fact that the Alex Pretty, the individual who was shot and killed on Saturday, there's now surface video showing that he was a bit more of an activist. Mm-hmm. And this is where allowing a little more data and information to come in is helpful. I mean, if I had a dime for every time in the initial coverage of the shooting, I think it would be fair to say that it was a pretty benign presentation.
Yeah.
Basically, he became known as the nurse who got shot immediately.
Right.
Which was a way of playing up, the fact that he was a victim here.
Right.
And finding this other complicating information, just to be clear, I'm not saying, if he was protesting, then all bets are off. But it is going to provide, it will be used by supporters of the Trump administration policy or people who want to slow down the rush to judgment against the officers as it's chum.
Right.
Right. It's not
yeah.
substantive in my view.
No.
I mean, I don't think it's reasonable at all to go, oh, well, if he was already a protester, well, then he was asking for it.
Right.
Right. I mean, just to be blunt about it. But some people will edge in the direction of that position. Well,
and this is where I think, you know, the real...
And that's just going to be part of the way in which the administration begins to crab walk a little bit, or a lot, frankly, from this initial position as expressed in the quotes we...
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the challenge here with all of this is that there's this quick rush to create a narrative, you know, and a narrative that serves a purpose, right? And so, and that's true on the right and the left around this, is that, you know, someone's either an angel or they're a demon, and here's all the evidence, right? You know, and therefore, the problem, though, is that, you know, we are still talking about fundamental constitutional rights, and whether you are a Second Amendment proponent or a First Amendment proponent, or you think that the First Amendment is the most important, you know, right, or the Second Amendment is the most important right, or whatever, ultimately, you've been living in a political universe in which these ideas have been mobilized repeatedly and effectively by politicians and reinforced as part of, you know, your political identity in some cases. And so once you start getting to that narrative space, you know, the problem becomes like, you know, I mean, I hate this because I don't want to be in this space, but like the hypocrisy problem just comes up for you. I mean, the whole motivated reasoning versus
cognitive dissonance. This really does circle back to the psychological mechanisms we were talking about.
Right.
A moment ago. If you're looking for a way to square facts that are or a series of events that are uncomfortable with your existing beliefs,
right,
you are going to seize on and overcount. In this case, I would say marginal evidence, but that you can use to square your initial. In other words,
yeah.
Oh, so he wasn't just a nurse. He was a protester who kicked out the taillight and had already had a skirmish with federal officials. So,
well, and I think this is where this is what makes this so hard. Also, is but it depends on how, you know, be fancy again, you know, how proximate or distal, you know, how close to your core identity those views are or not.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're thinking, you know, part of the challenge, I think, you know, for Republicans with again this untenable position on the gun issue, is that there are for those voters who are single issue voters for which gun rights are their primary issue. And we know for a fact that those voters primarily house within the Republican Party. We also know that those voters tend to participate in Republican primaries. Are they a majority in Republican primaries? Probably not. Are they holding views grossly at odds with the rest of the Republican primary electorate? No, but we've said for many years, especially in a state like Texas, if you come back to your primary audience as a Republican elected official and you create space for someone to challenge you as not sufficiently pro-Second Amendment, not sufficiently pro-life or whatever the thing is, you know, that's room for a primary challenger. That's what right. that is, because that's what, but here's the thing. That's still a very small group of people. And so for those people, telling them that, no, you know, this is actually this other thing, and actually you need to know about this guy so you know why. It's like, now look, there is a lot of reason that I think a lot of those, again, for a lot of those even single issue voters, those views are going to overlap with strongly pro-law enforcement, pro-military,
anti-immigration
views. Yeah. So, you know, you kind of got to deal with that too. And that's why I think, you know, not to like, you know, this is why like Democrats need to not get over their skis on this a little bit. You know, they know they're in a good position on the government funding deal because of the fact that in general, their party's completely unified. Independents are not pleased. And again, the Republicans see challenges, but they're not the same challenges,
right?
They're not the same challenges here. And so I think, you know, to the extent Democrats are bringing up Kyle Rittenhouse, it's like they could just not focus on their own thing. Republicans have enough to deal with on their own. And really, Democrats inserting themselves just bring back in essentially the sort of, you know, the kind of normal partisan politics of this is, which is like, yeah, sure, but like you want these guys to be in charge of the immigration? Oh, yeah, sure, but do you think they should make the gun laws? And then we just kind of get back snapped into the normal kind of partisan elements we expect.
Well, and you know, I think there's also the potential for a lot of gun rights advocates to be faced with the uncomfortable question mm-hmm. of, well, I'm more comfortable with, or the uncomfortable position of saying, I'm certainly much more comfortable with some people having gun rights than others.
And this is ultimately what this all. I mean, this is one of the.
I mean, I think that
this is what. Yeah, this is what the narrative piece of this kind of comes back to, which is, you know, when they study, you know, public opinion has studied Americans' views towards rights for a number of years, and in particular, kind of goes back to thinking about like whether communists should have the same rights as everybody else was kind of where a lot of this stuff was, and this was where this question of things like, you know, hey, so you're supportive of free speech rights? Okay, well, you know, what about someone you agree with in the town square? What about a communist? What about a Nazi? Kind of, you know, is sort of the general kind of gist of this. And what you find is not so surprising is that, you know, people's expression of willingness and support for rights tends to be a little bit more conditional than we might think it is, right?
Right.
And that's kind of one of the interesting other sort of undercurrents in all of this, which is sort of the way that free speech rights in and of itself is having a moment. I mean, in some ways in America, and that it's become this huge focal point, but it also is being reconfigured in a lot of different ways and instances and ways that are just really, I'd say they're difficult to square.
Yeah. Before we transition to the free speech rights, I do want to add another anecdote.
Yeah, please.
Or historical anecdote to the issue of gun rights for who.
Yeah.
And that is, if you go back in time to, I want to say it was the early 70s. It might have been the late 60s. One of the first upticks in restrictions on open carry in California at the state level came when the Black Panthers began displaying weapons in public in the name of, you know, community self-defense, however you want to interpret that. We'll not go down that rabbit hole. But the example stands.
No, it's really important. And I mean, I think, you know, we were talking about this on the way in, and I think, you know, and again, we're trying to kind of step away from the narrative identity, but it is notable that, you know, a white male legal gun owner, you know, is shot, and it sort of creates a very different reaction than a female lesbian, you know, clearly like a some sort of a liberal of some sort, you know, more standard, I guess, to people's, you know, archetypes. And that's created a different reaction.
Well, and that's why the attempt to recode Alex Preddy as a protester rather than a nurse who just happened upon this situation is going to be key to the way that this all gets.
Right. He had, the idea that he had intent and all that stuff.
So you raise free speech rights. And when we covered this subject, which we did without really reference to public opinion in our intro government course yesterday.
Right.
We talked quite a bit about the First Amendment rights here and the way that freedom to assemble, freedom of speech are implicated in how we might think about this, and we urge the intro students to make connections there. But we can turn that at about 90 degrees maybe and look at that in terms more strictly in terms of the politics. And as you mentioned, free speech has been having something of a moment, and in ways that are a little bit maybe not surprising, but certainly interesting.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, on the one hand, you know, and I'm going to be honest, you know, it's really hard to square all this. I can't come in here and say, here's a nice bow that I can wrap around this. So I just want to present some different, you know, observations and findings, and then kind of, maybe we'll just talk about it a little bit. But, you know, back in October of last year, we asked about the security of free state speech rights in America. You know, are they completely secure? Are they very secure, somewhat secure, not at all secure? And the thing to note is that the vast majority of respondents said either somewhat secure or not at all secure. Very few Americans were really willing to offer that free speech rights in America were extremely secure. But the interesting thing is, I'll say, and this is what's interesting, is Republicans significantly more so than were Democrats.
And just, you know, make sure we know exactly what the question was on that.
Yeah, sure. I think the question was, I don't actually have the question directly in front of me. Do you have it? Or
Well,
I think it was
we asked a battery of questions about threats to the United States.
Right. This one is separate from that.
And well, I'm looking at the 2024 one.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to get to that in a second.
I just
wanted to start off by pointing out that, you know, as recently as the end of last year, it wasn't as though Americans were saying, hey, you know, this is great. We've got great free speech rights going on here, whatever that means to people. Now, the other thing that we also asked about over time, and we've been asking this, we asked it back in 2023, 24, and 25, was about existential threats. Essentially, you know, there's different threats to the United States, internal and external, whether it's things like immigration, foreign nations, artificial intelligence, threats to free speech.
Yeah. Well, these are the same batteries. Yeah.
Yeah. And, And what we found in those is that basically back during the Biden administration, which is not, you know, again, it is what it is about partisanship, Republicans and conservatives in particular expressed very, very serious concern about threats to free speech rights. So back in 2023, 57% of Republicans said that restrictions on free speech rights were an extremely serious threat to the U.S. In 2024, it was 42%. Today, it's dropped down to about 26%.
Among Republicans.
Among Republicans. And so what you can see here is that, you know, there was this sort of concern that was floating around during much of the Biden administration about threats to sort of conservative free speech rights. The Trump administration has really ramped up those efforts. And you see that a lot, you know, not, you know, at universities in a lot of ways and in various, in particular about the free speech rights of conservatives. But ultimately, now you're seeing protests on the streets, which are, you know, very, very direct expression of First Amendment rights. I mean, really right down the middle, you know, in terms of what we think of. And yet you're seeing this aggressive response to them in a way that, you know, again, it kind of goes back to like, well, whose rights? When are we, you know, when do we care about free speech rights and when do we not care about free speech rights? This is all just to say that if you're looking at the data on this, it's really hard to square away. It's really hard to actually come up with a native story other than to say that Republicans were much more concerned about free speech when Biden was in office. They're much less concerned now. However, the demonstrable threats are pretty, you know, obvious, and Democrats are now overwhelmingly concerned about free speech rights.
Right. I mean, the interesting thing here is how they flip. I mean, right. One of the interesting things is how they flipped.
Right.
I mean, if you look at the two charts, and we'll put these on the website with the podcast and our blog space, Democrats are now more concerned than Republicans were.
Yeah, much more.
And Republicans have now the share that in 2025 that said restrictions on free speech were a very extremely serious threat to the United States is about the same as the level of Democrats who thought that in 2024.
Right. And what we find is that, you know, when we look at, you know, people's sort of willingness to express their political attitudes, what we generally find is that, you know, conservatives and Republicans are a little bit more comfortable across a variety of circumstances than our Democrats and liberals. Now, how much of that is right now, like the current moment? How much of that is a broader, you know, sort of, I would say more like state versus trait? We don't know at this point because we only asked the question once. But this is all to say, you know, this is a pretty interesting space. And this also speaks to, again, you know, in some ways, it speaks to my mind, at least, to sort of some of the normative threats that we're even talking about and why this is part of this battery. Is that, you know, when you think about something like free speech rights and the idea that people's views towards something as fundamental as like the First Amendment could basically flip on a dime on a year and on an election is problematic because these are the sort of the baseline understandings. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I'll say this. It's interesting watching the coverage. How many Democrats and liberals all of a sudden look like gun rights advocates, right? Not common, not something that you would have seen, you know, a couple years ago, certainly not in the wake of January 6th or anything like that. But all of a sudden, the shoe's on the other foot, and it's a little bit different. Now, to me, I'm not saying that as a criticism of anybody, but it's just sort of as an untethering in some ways.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you say that, and I would have to go back and look a little more systematically at Democratic responses. I think in the same way, I think Democrats are being a little more careful about crossing their base on the issue of gun rights.
Yeah.
Because on the face of it, and forgive the ruthlessness of this, but on the base of it, Democrats have plenty to work with here without the gun issue.
That's exactly what exactly. I totally agree with that.
I mean, and so they don't have to get in trouble with their base necessarily in the way that Republicans have somewhat blundered into, I would argue.
Right. Yeah.
And that are now having to correct on.
Yeah.
So it will be interesting to see how this unfolds on this front in terms of, you know, thus far, I think because the other issues, the issues of state power.
Yeah. Which, I mean, we're not even talking about it, but that's a really interesting other
cross immigration
here. Yeah.
Already give, and again, to go back to our 310, not very sexy, but also federalism.
Yeah. No, I mean.
You know, self-rule, you know, autonomy of. Has been an issue that Republicans or that Democrats have been working on this because, again, they have a lot to work with.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean they're going to win the fight. But in terms of how they mobilize their base and how they're thinking about entering the politics of this in this environment, with the Republican monopoly and power in D.C., Democrats are having to operate more as an opposition party, and they've got, you know, I agree with you, they've got to be careful about getting over their skis on this.
Yeah.
But they do have, it's a little easier for them, let's put it this way, in political terms, and they've not had, you know, this is unusual for Democrats to some degree, they've not experienced thus far the degree of unforced errors that we've seen on the Republican side.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I could almost imagine a world where, you know, if the Democratic Party was solely focused on winning and didn't have to deal with sort of, you know, their own internal politics, you know, you could in some ways run on this as just a performance evaluation. Say, look, you know, hey, immigration is a problem. We all agree about that, but they're messing this up. You know, they're not doing this the right way. And that's the problem. We're not talking about the gun. We're not saying that everybody should jump into a protest with a gun. We're not about to like flip on that. But here we can say on performance, on the issue that he is. And this is the thing where I think, you know, this is why I'm curious to see how long the walk back happens, because a lot of complexities there and how far it goes. But I mean, part of this is, look, you know, there's a lot of polling going on right now. And we talked at length in this podcast in Texas, but also nationally, immigration and border security has been the strength that the president has been leaning on relative to much weaker ratings on things like the economy, healthcare, right, prices, which are really important to people. And so ultimately, like, you can't have a cratering here. This is the thing that, you know, they're relying on to mobilize Republican voters. They can't be having a fight about it.
Right. And we're hearing this a lot from the members of Congress that are raising their heads above the hedge on the Republican side.
Right.
Every political newsletter yesterday virtually had, usually, though not tellingly, not all blind quotes saying, mm-hmm. hey, this is our issue. You know, we can't turn this into a loser.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I'm sure I read that.
And pretty,
quote.
You know, pretty direct.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was that blunt. I mean, right?
And, you know, so there was that message. And then, of course, as we used in the course yesterday, not a majority of Republicans, but enough Republicans sending messages. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Abbott and Ted Cruz saying, hey, you know, we need a course correction here.
Right.
And to the point you were making a minute ago, just current events, as we're recording this on, you know, a few minutes before noon by now on Thursday, Tom Homan has met with people in Minneapolis and the bargaining is underway that I think are illustrating this political dynamic. And this is really what I had in mind at the beginning when I saw, okay, we're getting a little bit back to normal where Tom Homan has arrived as the person who's going to be the voice of reason.
Right.
And for anybody that's followed Tom Homan at all, you didn't hear, you know, I'll just put it this way. He presents as a very gruff, no nonsense. I've done this job for a bunch of different presidents. We're just here. He really hits hard on criminality, which is where the public opinion sweet spot is, even allowing for partisanship. Mm-hmm. But his manner is not, they sent in a peacemaker.
Right.
But what is politics of normal about this is Homan did a press conference this morning, started by saying, very conventional, I've met with the mayor of Minneapolis, I've met with the governor, we're talking about, you know, pulling out some of our presence, but we're going to need things from them, and that those things are going to be better cooperation with us on people accused of crimes that are already in the jails here, and we need to be able to get to them easily. And the very quick response from Minneapolis guys were, hey, we've been doing that.
Yeah, exactly.
We're not here to protect criminals either. So
cool
your jets on that. And that kind of discussion, while that goes on and the days tick off and a shutdown does or doesn't happen and whatever else is happening in the world goes on and interest rates stay the same.
Right.
You know, this is a very typical calibration allowing for whether Donald Trump can move away from it or not, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, I
think that, you know, the newscast headed last night almost uniformly, near as I can tell from going back and looking, with Donald Trump kind of playing it both ways in that press scrum.
It's really very American to have a, as you put it, a typical calibration in the face of horrific tragedy.
Yeah,
Well, that's very, you know, very American politics, right?
That's politics, I think. So, you know, I think we ought to just leave it there. So with that, thanks for coming in. It's warming up a little, but it was still chilly this morning.
Yeah, that's great.
Thanks a lot to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio and the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. As always, great job prepping, very tolerant of us kind of just shooting the breeze as we were getting ready. Thanks to all of you for listening. Again, we've talked about a lot of data here, links, graphics, and you can download these graphics for free at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. So again, thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with another Second Reading Podcast. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.